Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorn sponsored today's episode. Thorn takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorn, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorn. Go to thorn.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorn.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Stoic.
Hey, it's Ryan. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. This is the time of year in Austin where it gets like amazing. It's my wife and I were just talking about this. It's you know, like night is darkest right before the dawn. Austin has this sort of weird cycle where it's like you think it's spring and then no, it gets cold again. And then you think it's spring and then it gets cold. We call it we have three fake springs and then winter returns. But now it's like actually spring, like after South by spring starts and just like we just looked out on our farm yesterday and just like, boom, everything had gotten green like immediately. And it was so amazing. And we have now this sort of very deep rooted memory of how beautiful and awe-inspiring is because in those sort of quiet days in the early days of the pandemic, we just had so much more time and life had become so much quieter and so much more still that we really soaked it in and appreciated it. And now I have this feeling of like the blackberries are going to start soon and we're going to be picking those. And now it gets dark later so we can go on walks after dinner for longer. I don't know. I'm feeling good about how things are. And I know I was just talking about this earlier this week, but I don't know. I'm feeling some enthusiasm and excitement and some natural beauty is soaking into my system after a dark, cold winter, at least by Texas standards. I'm excited for what is to come. I can already feel the energy as people are coming into the bookstore. Anyways, today's episode is about someone that I've wanted to read a great book about for a long time, but I have not found one. I wrote about Angela Merkel in Ego is the Enemy. She's one of the characters because she's one of the few statesmen or stateswomen of history who no one would say has a huge ego. I read a really great New Yorker piece about her that formed the basis of a lot of what I wrote. But there wasn't the perfect book. And I picked up a bunch and I didn't like them until I read earlier this year, The Chancellor, The Remarkable Odyssey of Angela Merkel by Kati Martin, who is a delightful biographer of Angela Merkel. And
more than just a writer. She's had a long career as an acclaimed reporter, and as well as being a human rights advocate. And she's published 9 books. She's worked at NPR. She was the ABC News bureau chief in Germany. And what I loved about this book, just a little taste from Kati, is, you know, she also grew up behind the Iron Curtain. And so she's able to, I think, really bring us inside those early formative years of this totally fascinating world leader, a leader cut from different cloth, a different mold. And it just made for a fantastic book. I can't recommend The Chancellor, The Remarkable Odyssey of Angela Merkel enough. I was really looking forward to this interview. I think it went great. And there was some selfish reasons for me wanting to do it. Not only did I read the book because I was interested in it, but my newest book, which will be the second book in my Stoic Virtues series, the sequel to Courage is Calling, is about temperance, moderation, self-control, temperament. And I really wanted to write about Angela Merkel, and I did. She's a main character in the book, as is Queen Elizabeth II. And I had a bunch of questions, so you'll notice I'm talking to Kati about this. And hopefully that's a little peek behind what's to come from me. But I'll just get into the interview because it was great. I think you'll enjoy it. Do check out The Chancellor. You can pick it up in the Painted Porch Bookshop, I believe, or anywhere books are sold. And you can follow the wonderful author at Kati Martin. That's KATIMARTON. Here's an insight into one of the most politically successful and morally unique leaders in the world, Angela Merkel. I absolutely loved the book.
Oh, thanks, Ryan. Oh, it was the Everest of writing projects.
Well, I've looked at a couple of the other books about Merkel, and I was very much waiting for this book because...
Oh, thanks.
The blurb that said, you're closer than anyone to unlocking the mystery, I thought that was quite correct.
Well, that was what I was aiming for.
What are the Library America books you have behind you? What are those? Is that Stephen Crane that I see?
Yes. So we've got... we've got a modest collection of Kati's books.
Yes.
And we have Richard's To End a War, which I think should be required reading right about now.
Yes.
Eight of my 10. That's kind of gross, isn't it?
No, you got to have them somewhere.
I wrote my master's thesis on this guy, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. So he's up there.
And then what are the Library of America books?
So the Library of America books, you can't these. So we've got Henry James, we've got Dreiser, we've got Stephen Crane, you're quite right. We've got O'Neill and the complete plays of Eugene O'Neill.
Ah, so just fiction.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I love about this otherwise unlovable Zoom world is that we do get to see each other's collections, except for one person. Can you guess the person who doesn't have a single personal item behind her? Just take a wild guess.
Yeah, I would guess she would use some sort of a screen. And not bother to show anything.
None of our business. It's so typical, you know, no art, no nothing. You know, and no one's ever been in her home. No one from her staff. I assume her husband's been there.
Well, I wanted to ask you, actually, that's sort of where I was thinking about starting, because you do mention one thing. I think you said it was on her desk. What's the little paperweight with the slogan on it?
So I did sneak into her office, full disclosure. Also not a simple operation. And it's a plexiglass cube that says "In der Ruhe liegt die Kraft, and that means in calm, there is strength, which is truly her mantra. That is among her superpowers, Ryan, is that she does not lose her cool. And, you know, God knows autocrats from Trump to Putin have tried to shake that surreal calm of hers, but she ain't going there. She just doesn't meet them where they want to be met, which is on their playing field of bloviation and insults. She just doesn't take the bait, and that drives them bonkers.
Do you know the origins of that quote, where she got it from, how it came to be on her desk? I never heard it before.
No, me neither. You know what? I'm gonna take a guess. Goethe. I assume it's Goethe because she swears by Goethe, you know, one of the gods of German high culture. And it seems like having been to Goethe's house in Weimar, it had that vibe. It had that hyper calm feeling. So let me just try Goethe for that.
Yeah, your point about not being provoked, that seems like an underrated skill in a leader. I think we want passionate leaders, right? We want leaders who, and then of course, leadership obviously selects for the driven, for the ambitious, for someone with something to prove, all of that. So you end up not getting very often leaders who can't be provoked, but that's almost like at least at that level, at the height of power, is probably the ultimate skill or the ultimate tool in the toolkit because people are trying to provoke you all the time.
Yeah, it seems so obvious. And yet, as you say, because she projects negative charisma, which is born of the fact that she doesn't emote in public. It's hard to imagine her going too far in our political culture because we really want to be entertained. And the Germans have been there. They paid a very high price for their entertainer in chief, and so I'm not sure that she would in fact, sad to say, I'm sure that she wouldn't thrive in our environment of you know, we want bloviators, it seems, and you know, it just seems like we don't learn from choosing repeatedly the theatrical over the entertainer over the guy who's going to be interested in us.
The executive.
Yes. But she's more than that. She's more than an executive. She's way more than that.
Do you think it's partly counter-programming? I mean, we have the stereotype that women are more emotional than men. How much of that is just naturally who she is, and how much of it is she understands that the expectation or the criticism might be this, and she's trying to very much go in the opposite direction?
Definitely partly that. She had so much to overcome. I mean, you know, here's this woman coming from East Germany. She was 35, as you know, when she first crossed from East to West Berlin. So a fully formed person. And she was a physicist, so a scientist. And above all, a woman in a country that never even had a queen, I think uniquely in Europe. So she had so much to overcome. So yes, she was, because she's quite brilliant, she observed what works and what doesn't work. She's always learning, even now. She processes new information like nobody's business. You know, voracious reader. I mean, it kind of breaks my heart to even be talking about this because there's no one like her on the world stage. No one who comes close to having her personal story, the prime feature of which is that this is a woman who lived for 35 years in a police state and for whom the word freedom is not a big abstraction. It means not being able to read the books you want to read, not being able to travel to the western sector of the country to visit your relatives. It means daily seeing that hideous monument to man's inhumanity to man, which was the wall, because on her way to her lab every morning, her subway rattled past that. These experiences really were foundational for her, and I maintain that they really served the entire world for the last 16 years, because we had such a person, such a calm and extraordinarily centered as an oak tree, Angela Merkel, which doesn't mean she's boring. That was one of the pleasant surprises of my 5 years search for who is Angela Merkel, is that she's not really who we think she is.
I'm writing about Merkel and Queen Elizabeth in the book that I'm doing now, which is about sort of temperance and self-discipline. And it struck me that they both came to very similar places from very similar, dissimilar paths. But there does seem to me to be a sort of a personality overlap there. Ironically, one is much more powerful than the other, right? Queen Elizabeth's power is all symbolic, and right. Merkel's power was literal and real, and yet they both seem to be very circumscribed in how they act, how they treat that role, I was curious what you thought of the similarities and differences there.
Well, I don't think Merkel would like the comparison.
Really?
I remember once asking her, she has a tiny circle of trusted confidants, like three or four. I mean, so small that when Obama went to say goodbye to Merkel in 2016, and he looked around her office, that her team had gathered there, he looked around and he said, "Wow, you guys still all here?" Because it was exactly the same team as 8 years before. Remarkable loyalty to the boss. So which is telling about who she is. Anyway, once I asked one of those three people who was extremely helpful to me, I was observing the chancellor at a refugee event. And being an American, I whispered to her, "Why doesn't she announce something that, you know, she will?" And the aide said, "Well, you know, she's not the Queen of England. She doesn't make these appearances and say flowery words. She's here because she wants to learn." And that was she kind of put me down with that line that she's not the Queen of England, because she is running a country.
Sure.
She is in the throes of a hellacious humanitarian crisis. This was 2015 when 1 million Middle Eastern refugees were allowed to enter Germany. You know, Merkel's probably most emotional and longest lasting move. And for once it was not, she didn't factor in, she didn't weigh all the advantages versus the disadvantages, which is how she normally operates.
Sure.
It's an interesting concept, and I'll be looking for your arguments, but Merkel also benefits from the fact that she can leave.
Right.
In fact, just left. And, you know, as much as she must be absolutely shattered observing what's going on, in Ukraine, the very thing she worked 16 years to prevent, you know, this is precisely the scenario that she devoted all those hundreds of hours to trying to talk sense to Vladimir Putin, now coming to pass just weeks after her departure. By the way, not a coincidence in my view.
I was just going to ask what you thought. Yes.
Not a coincidence at all. No, I think Putin is testing the will of the West, of the EU, and of Washington. He saw a great deal of vulnerability in both Washington and Berlin with a brand new chancellor, and I think he absolutely miscalculated, and the really tragic piece of this, among many, is that there's no one there like Merkel who might have talked sense to him, because Merkel was the one head of state that he truly respects. And literally, they speak the same language, being both of them products of the same Soviet foundation. Obviously, they came out with different conclusions about that system. She considered the end of the Soviet Empire her liberation and the beginning of her restarting her life as a politician, because she'd been, as I said, she'd been in a lab for most of her adult life. And the night the wall fell, she literally took off her white coat and went looking for a political party for that same night for Putin, who was in those days KGB agent in Dresden, was catastrophic. And he has many times said that the demise of the Soviet Empire was the great tragedy of the 20th century. By the way, he spent that night shoveling documents and files into his furnace. So at such a speed that it exploded.
So how much do you think his sort of begrudging respect for her comes to what we were just talking about, which is that she seemed to be of the world leaders, the one that he couldn't provoke, the one that whose goat he couldn't get? You tell the story in the book about his little incident with his hunting dogs.
Oh, my God. Yes. Oh, her staff was just furious, because he knew, of course, being a KGB agent, he did his due diligence and knew that she was afraid of dogs having been bitten. So he unleashed this big black lab, Coney, who immediately went for Merkel and was sniffing around her. And Merkel typically just kind of froze. Her staff was going bananas, just appalled. And afterwards, she said to them, "You know, this is all he's got.
Yeah,
he's got to do this." So she so totally saw through his macho exterior, as she did Trump's. The need to always be the top dog and the need to dominate. And she managed to make them both look kind of pathetic, kind of ridiculous. And she one of her stratagems in negotiating with Putin or any other super macho guy, be it Erdogan or Trump or Putin, is that when they're erupting in verbiage about all the injustices that they have suffered, their people have suffered, and all how it's time to correct history and blah blah blah, she lets them go on. She never interrupts. She lets these volcanic eruptions pass, and then she repeats what they just said, but in very plain, almost childlike phrases, which make them sound pretty damn ridiculous. So this is what you so she replays what they sure. just played. Instead of meeting bombast with bombast, she meets it with calm reason. And that does take the supreme self-control of someone who learned very early not to call attention to herself. And because there was no value in that in the Stasi state. And she was always the most brilliant kid in the class, whatever the class was. And you see in the photographs in my book that she's always sitting near the end, near the back of the class, and never calls attention to herself.
I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Yeah, I can imagine her waiting for one of those eruptions to wrap up and then go, are you finished? Right?
Yes.
Yes. Sort of self-control to not be provoked in it, but also not to take it. She's taking it for granted. Or she's taking it at face value, but also not, right? She's not, she understands that it's a performance.
Yes.
It's not actually, and that to take it seriously is to get sucked into it.
Yes. Yes. On the other hand, it's, you know, unlike the queen, to return to your analogy, she has to deliver. It's not enough for her to show up and as the symbol of the state, beautifully turned out, which she rather rarely is beautifully turned out. That's not among her skill set. But she has to actually execute. She has to deliver fuel. She has to make sure that the extreme right stays within a very confined space. That nuclear power is never going to jeopardize German. The health of the nation, as she observed in Japan with Fukushima, after which she took Germany off the nuclear grid, a controversial. In other words, she's always managing a crisis. There was never a month that was crisis free from 2005 to the. Just a few weeks ago. I mean, it was just one rolling crisis.
Yeah, I was going back to that dog incident. I think is so impressive about it too is like if you've ever been around someone who's afraid of dogs, or if you're afraid of dogs, the tricky thing is the dog also senses it, right? The dog senses your unstable, potentially dangerous energy, and it's a feedback loop, right?
Right.
The dog's uncertain, and then you're like this, and that's a and so.
I what I find so impressive about that is not just she understands that there's this sort of global exchange happening between her and Putin, but also she legitimately is afraid of dogs, and she somehow manages to keep that under wraps in that yes. moment too.
Yes,
it's pretty impressive.
It is, but again, I was born and raised into a similar system in Soviet occupied Hungary, the child of jailed journalists, and so I know what fear does and how it infects your DNA, and certainly I was raised by two. I was a little kid when we escaped from Hungary and did observe tanks in my hometown, so. Soviet tanks rolling into Budapest. So observing Ukraine has a
sure.
personal resonance for me in all its horror. But the idea that she learned to master fear and knew that that she had to assume that. People were informing on her from the beginning. And in fact, her lab partner, whom she was close friends with, was a pretty much a full-time informer. He totally betrayed her trust. And that was just a reminder of something that her parents had prepared her for, which is that eventually they will try to recruit you, as they did. I mean, the Stasi had deeper penetration of East Germany than the Gestapo had of Hitler's Germany. I cite statistics in my book as to, one agent for every, 20 people. I mean, it was crazy. So it was that level of suspicion and almost paranoia, in fact, has been an advantage for her in her political life because one of her great assets is that people are endlessly underestimating her.
Sure.
Including, all her mentors who, just saw this brilliant woman who can't possibly be a threat to them. Well, guess what? Because she knew how to contain whatever it was she was planning, whatever ambition, and she had vast ambitions for herself. One of the reasons that she left science was that she was a good scientist, but she didn't think she was Nobel Prize material. So in other words, whatever she was going to do,
she wanted to do it at the highest level.
The top. Yep. She was going to be chancellor or nothing.
Well, and that's what when I see the similarity between her and the queen is the ability to wear the mask, right?
Yes.
And to have the self-control to be okay being underestimated. Like I think of the queen and her sort of weekly meetings with the prime minister. She knows more than every one of the prime ministers. I mean, she's dealt with 12 of that person, right? Like she's been in that chair for longer than that person has been alive in many cases.
Yes.
And so there's a certain amount of egolessness required to being comfortable being underestimated. She understood that Merkel did that her male mentors were using her or seeing her as a tool or not a threat.
Yes.
And she was strong enough not to correct them of that helpful assumption.
Absolutely. She, as I say somewhere in my book, that she may never have torched her rivals, but she certainly never ran for the fire hose when they were self-immolating. That was her.
Sure.
But, if I can just underscore the one obvious contrast between Her Majesty the Queen. I have nothing against her. I don't live in a monarchy, but...
Likewise.
Yeah, okay. Queen Elizabeth was born into this role.
Yes.
Angela Merkel, however we want to brutalize her name, she had to fight for every inch of territory.
Sure.
As I've pointed out, the triple the triple outsider, the scientist, the woman, and from the East. So, you know, and yet never breaks a sweat, sure. Never reveal that, just pretend that you don't notice when the guys are plotting who's going to be the one to take her down, as they were, you know, just soldier on and learn from the best and observe what pulls down the weak and the corrupt, and hold your cards extremely close to the vest. So you know, these are extraordinary skills. And sometimes I felt like I was writing Machiavelli volume 2 called The Princess.
Yeah.
Because you know, there are so many lessons in this tale for not only for people with political ambitions, but I think for all of us. I know that in the process of trying to decode this extraordinarily opaque personality, I learned so much. I mean, I approach situations now with kind of one eye cocked, you know, I don't want to say I ask myself every morning, what would Merkel do? But I do think that in a bunch of ways, it's changed me. It's made me more, less impulsive,
sure.
I weigh whatever mantras, the advantages outweigh the disadvantages, because it's very rare that you know, things are that clear. And above all, I try not to react to, you know, when I'm pissed off, which we are daily, you know,
sure.
Especially, you know, during COVID, how often, you know, were we ready to scream in frustration at whatever? I've tried, she's made me a calmer person. So my children are grateful.
Where do you think there's a sort of a certain stoicism to her, right?
Yes.
Yes. Where does that come from? Is that the religious training? Is that the scientific sort of focus mm-hmm. on the rational mind? Did she have a philosophical or political hero that she was modeling herself against? Where does the sort okay, well, of persona just, come from?
Yeah, you've just listed a bunch of them. So, first of all, she is a woman of deep but extremely private faith. She is the pastor's daughter. Her father had an enormous influence on her. He was a rather austere, rather forbidding, not a cuddly guy. She never fully got his affirmation, his approval. He never voted for her, which is, I found remarkable. Neither of her parents did. So the Lutheran faith, which for her is about a sense of responsibility for those less fortunate, and also she scorns, you know, flash and wealth, and you know, here, I mean, the idea that she left the chancellery a few weeks ago and returned to her rent-controlled apartment in central Berlin. No palaces, no yachts, no nada.
No $20 million Netflix deal after, like that.
No, I mean, that would run completely against the grain for her. Any show, she considers all, you know, acquisitions, property, so on, really burdensome. They slow you down. She loves nature. Her staff calls her rambles in the woods near her very modest little, you can't even call it a country house. It's a typical East German style dacha, where she and her husband go, and she loves to go for rambles there. Her staff calls that her think tank, because that's where she goes to be quiet and to think. And I'm guessing she's spending a lot of time there now.
Sure.
But for her to you know, maintain the kind of Putin-like palace would be a colossal waste of time. And you know, you can only imagine what she thinks of the wealth that this man who was paid $140,000 a year has accumulated. He is supposedly the wealthiest man in the world. So you can only imagine what she thinks of that, or of Trump. She was never invited to Mar-a-Lago. She lived in fear of being invited to Mar-a-Lago because she might have had to accept. So just to fully answer your question about where this comes from. So it's the faith. It's the love of nature. It's the fact that she spent her youth in a very remote corner of Germany, Brandenburg. And that was partly where she learned to rely on herself for her and to draw on her own resources. You know, she was a country girl; she was not a city girl. By the time she got to Berlin, which was after she got her PhD to begin work in the East German Academy of Sciences, she was a fully formed person. So she was never an urbanite, though she loves culture and loves that I don't think that she's going to be people are endlessly asking me, so what is she going to do now? And the thing she isn't going to do is take another job. What job is there after 16 years as Chancellor of Germany? But nor is she ever going to be bored, because she is so turned on by culture, music and opera and plays and books. She's a voracious reader. That was one way that she escaped the kind of confinement of living in the Stasi state, was that her parents, who were originally from the West, I mean, this is another really bizarre thing, is that when all the traffic was from East to West, escaping the Red Army, her family, Merkel's family, chose the opposite route and went from West to East, because her father took up the challenge to minister in the atheist communist state. And of course, that's why Merkel grew up in that atheist communist state. But they did take with them a rather rich library of books, and that's how she discovered. For example, you asked earlier about her heroes and role models, and one of them is Catherine the Great. Kind of ironic, the German princess who became the Tsarina of Russia, and she has a portrait of her in her office. So, and Ukraine comes into this story too, bizarrely, because Catherine the Great conquered Ukraine.
So when you were saying earlier, you said you didn't think she could be successful in the American political system.
No, but, I don't.
It does feel like, as sort of naturally reserved and sort of indifferent as she is to, fashion or makeup or appearances, she's, as you said, sort of anti-charismatic. You do talk quite a bit in the book about how she figured out how to play the game and got, like, you can't serve 16 years as a politician without being a pretty decent politician. And you can't do it in the information age without being pretty good at managing your image and mastering these sort of new media tools. So she does figure these things out.
She does. But on the other hand, I think part of her survival mechanism, I mean, how do you survive 60 years of one crisis after the next, and maintain your balance? And one way is that she doesn't do social media. She's not out there. She is, I have Germans asking me, as her biography, does Chancellor have any grandkids?
Right. They don't know that she doesn't have children.
They don't. No. Wow. I mean, that is available information.
Sure.
But she doesn't, sit down and you know, give interviews about her, you know, her wonderful marriage or her potato soup recipe or whatever. You know, there's none of that. She just doesn't think it's anybody's business. And that fact, and here's another lesson from Machiavelli Volume 2, is if you don't give it all away to the public, you know, that liberates a large part of you, that frees a large part of you to actually maintain life as a normal human.
Sure.
Which she's about as normal a human as any supremely powerful player on the world stage has ever been, because she didn't reveal everything. I say in the book that Germans aren't tired of her looming over them because she doesn't loom.
Sure.
So it was a clever thing, but it also in that, you know, they didn't really get tired of her in an age when, you know, our attention span is shrinking by the minute. They weren't tired of her because she wasn't in their face at all. And that helped her tremendously as well.
But and do you think a little bit that some of it is expertly done political theater, like deciding it's not that she doesn't, focus, let's say, on clothes, but she makes it clear that she's not focusing on clothes because she's focusing on doing her job. Right. Or even, you know, is the, hey, I'm going to go get my groceries at the grocery store like a normal person. But is part of that also being seen around the people and sort of is part of it expertly managed theater also?
Look, she is a complex human being, unlike the rest of us. Simple.
Yes, right.
Of course, she knows that some of this really plays well. And the fact that she lives like most Germans is pretty appealing. And that in 16 years, there hasn't been a breath of scandal. Nor any tell-all books. I mean, imagine an American.
There's barely president. Any regular books, let alone tell-all books.
Yes, yes. And I think my book is far more revealing than any other, because not that I uncovered all sorts of scandals, not at all, but that I do attempt to get beneath the surface of her. But she did figure out that she had to make a non-story out of the fact that she had no fashion sense. And so she was very strategic in that she engaged a Hamburg designer who filled her closet with the Merkel uniform, her equivalent of a man's pinstripe suit, which is jewel tone jackets in endless shades, and black trousers. I once caught her shopping for shoes in a department store in Berlin. And while
that even happened is such an absurdly emblematic illustration of who she is.
Yeah. While she hates to have her security anywhere in her line of sight. So they kind of pretended to be shoppers, and she bought the same identical pair of black flats, I think six pairs of them. So, you know, it was not like, you know, like most women, I really enjoy buying shoes, but not six of the same, you know. And the same with grocery shopping. She really enjoys that. And one of the iconic photographs to have come out of the COVID era, over which she very competently ruled, showed her the day after she gave probably the most emotional speech of her career. And because she doesn't give speeches, everybody paid attention. With the iconic backdrop of the Reichstag behind her, and she told the nation in the most human terms that this is serious and that we're going to have to make sacrifices, but that we have to look after each other. And please do not hoard. she promised people that there would be that the markets would have sufficient contents. And the next day she was seen, and I have this photograph in my book, pushing a shopping cart with the same number of bottles of wine as rolls of toilet paper, four of each. So, you know, she's very clever. She's also, by the way, extraordinarily witty. She's got a killer sense of humor, which unfortunately she doesn't display in public.
Do you think that perhaps I imagine this is connected to her humor, but you just said that when she gave the speech, people listened. Do you think one of the sort of ancillary benefits of not always seeking the spotlight, always bloviating, is that when you speak, people listen? You know, there's a famous line from Cato. He said, "I only speak when I'm confident that what I have to say is better not left unsaid." Right. And yes. And that seems to encapsulate how she approaches communication.
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, because she has a lot of self-awareness, she also knows that public speaking is not her friend. She was suspicious of Obama at the outset because she thought he was just that, a young man in a hurry who had a silver tongue. It took her a while to figure out that he was actually a serious, substantial guy. But theirs was a not always smooth relationship.
Yeah, David Halberstam in his book about Bill Belichick, he said Bill Belichick was not only in the steak business, he had contempt for sizzle. Right. And that seems to be her approach as well. She's skeptical of, she's not only sort of isn't charismatic, but it seems that she might be skeptical of charisma in other people because it might mean that there's more style than substance.
Yes. And also that charisma can lead to very dangerous developments. I mean, you know, she of all the modern German leaders is the one who has most assimilated the lessons of the Holocaust and has made in a really historic speech to the Knesset in Jerusalem, she identified Israel's security as a foundational reason for the German state to exist. So she tied Germany's destiny to that of another country, Israel. Why? Because even though she was raised in the East, they invented this mythology that all the Nazis were from the West and that all the good Germans were from the East, and therefore the East never went through the confrontation with the past that the West did, and by the way, that has been a real problem for Merkel because two reasons. One, she didn't pay sufficient attention to the fact that most East Germans, her fellow East Germans, you know, couldn't restart their engines as fast as she did.
Sure.
And she was impatient with them. And therefore, she didn't acknowledge them to the extent that they felt they needed to be acknowledged for their suffering. And so a lot of the so-called AfD, the far-right party, which is in the Bundestag for the first time since the Second World War, is from her region of East Germany. And they're disgruntled. And it's not the economy, stupid. It's about, you know, this is also a blind spot of hers, is that because she's such a hyper-rational person, she underestimates the role that the irrational plays for most of us.
Is that that strikes me as maybe something that she and Obama share? When you're a very rational, you have control of your temperament, you're very brilliant, it makes it hard for you to understand / accommodate people who are
not just not that, but maybe the opposite of that.
Yes. Yes. She actually, she and Obama are much alike in that regard. They're dissimilar in other fundamental ways, which I relate. But Obama so trusted her more than any other. I mean, Ben Rhodes, whom I interviewed for this book, said that the word, he can't avoid the word love to describe how Obama felt about Merkel, and she was the only one for whom he felt that. However, when Putin started acting up in 2014, moving in on Ukraine, Obama didn't have the patience to engage with Putin.
Yeah.
And said to Merkel, you know, that man just lies to me morning, noon, and night. And well, of course, he lied to her too. But you know, you look at the map and you realize that Russia's not going away and Germany's right there. And in fact, I quote Bismarck, the first German chancellor, as saying that the key to a sound German foreign policy is to make a good treaty with Russia. That was in the 19th century, and it's true today. So she was the one who carried the baton for the West.
Sure.
In those endless hours, hunched over a table in Minsk, where she said that the only way she knew the time of day was whether they were serving bread and jam or a roast. So that level of focus and concentration and stamina, you know, the ability to just stay at the table until you find common ground is really what diplomacy is about. And very few heads of state have the patience, the stamina, the strategic thinking. And the other thing that she brings to the table is, and this is again goes back to her brilliance, her photographic memory, is that no one, including Putin, can match her for mastery of detail and fact. She said at one point during the Ukraine crisis that she knew every tree in the Donbas, because she was following, sure, you know, even though Putin kept denying that these were not his guys, you know, they were called little green men because they didn't have any insignia. His men were, you know, overnight moving, and she knew every inch of territory that they were taking. And man, do we miss that kind of adult supervision of Putin now, because you don't see him hunched over a map with anybody now.
Sure.
And that's a tragedy for all of us.
I was struck by the chapter in the book on her relationship with her husband. You tell the story, which I'd heard before, about him not attending her inauguration and such. I can't tell if that's cute or sad.
Yeah. Well, look, it might be sad for you and me, but it works for them. They've been together for many decades, and part of their deal is that he gets to do what he likes to do, and she gets to do what she likes to do. He's a very distinguished quantum chemist, well known in his field, and the only person who ever called him Mr. Merkel was Nicolas Sarkozy. And it didn't go over too well, because Merkel is the name that she kept from her first
marriage,
a very brief starter marriage, you know, based partly on, I mean, they were she married Ulrich Merkel, who was a fellow student in Leipzig, and married him because you got better apartments if you were a married couple. I mean, they also loved each other, I think, but she outgrew him pretty quickly. But the marriage is very close, and absolutely private. Absolutely. He's never given a single interview about her. Can you imagine?
It's incredible. I mean, I think that's the worry or the suspicion that people have, you know, when you see these people who are very calm and cool and collected, that maybe they're just not capable of emotional intimacy. Not that they're keeping it out of the workplace, but that they're somehow robotic and not capable of that closeness or connection. But you do you think that that's not the case with her?
Not at all. I've seen her tear up a couple of times. She teared up at a memorial for World War I at Verdun, where you know, it's just, I don't know if you've ever been there. I mean, it's just one of those battlefields with just endless crosses across rolling green fields, kind of like the landing beaches in Normandy. I mean, it just boggles the mind to think of that many fallen, and you look at the graves and they're, you know, very young soldiers, German and French. And part of this, the commemoration was that young Germans and French kids just bounded with white streamers among the graves, and she teared up at the, you know, at the notion that their grandparents had died in those beautiful fields for an inch of territory, and she so hates war. So that was one time she emoted, and the other time was, which really had historic consequences, when she met this refugee girl in the summer of 2015. I call that chapter the Summer of Reem, because Reem was this little girl who was picked for a town hall as a sort of model refugee girl, and she started weeping into the microphone, saying that all my friends are making their plans, but I can't because I don't have the security of being able to stay in this country. I want to stay in this country. And Merkel was, she whispered into her own, my God. I mean, she was completely blown away by that. And then subsequently had the girl to the chancellery a couple of times. The girl and her family, of course, have now been given permanent asylum in Germany, along with 1 million other Middle Eastern refugees. And, you know, her Republican friends like Henry Kissinger, a mentor of hers, said to her, Angela, to allow one refugee in is a humanitarian act, but to allow 1 million is to destroy German culture and civilization. Well, guess what? That Henry was wrong. That did not happen. And for the most part, that 1 million population of refugees have been integrated into German society. It's not even a big subject anymore. I mean, it certainly isn't today, because today it's all Putin.
Isn't that the irony, though, that after 16 years, or not quite, but after a decade and a half of rational, almost wonkish sort of policy decisions sort of fact-based solution, you know, focused decisions, devoid of emotion or grandstanding or any of that, that her greatest decision and her most inspiring and perhaps most permanent part of her legacy was the opposite of all of that?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Where are you going with that?
Just that she has this playbook, this rule book that she follows her whole career. And then she has the ability to throw it out at the last second to do her greatest bit of work.
Well, see, I don't quite see it that way, because I think that her moral code has always been operational. It was just the first time that it was really tested, because until then she was dealing with things like the nuclear crisis, the Euro crash, having to figure out, you know, how to deal with populists. You know, those were not emotional issues. This was this was the equivalent of, you know, if there had been a wave of anti-Semitism. So I don't, to me, it was all of a piece, because as much as she doesn't talk about her faith, it's so obvious that is the her core, and that is the secret of what has sustained her and what drives her. You know, it's her ambition is real, but it's not sort of empty ambition. She really does believe that she can deliver for not only her people, but for the world. I think her big disappointment is that she was just about to focus on climate. Her 2020 January New Year's speech was that's the one speech a year that she can be counted on to deliver. And she said that now I'm going to focus on climate because I haven't been able to. And then 6 weeks later came COVID. So, you know, if I were to hazard a guess as to where we will be hearing from Merkel after, you know, let's give her a little break now.
Sure.
Although I sincerely hope that she's on the phone to her successor about how to deal with Putin. I'm sure she is. I'm sure she is. And probably even to Biden. I think the issues of climate and the urgency of climate, that'll be one. And the other, I would guess, would be women who are still far from empowered, in particularly in Africa. I think she'll be stepping up to those issues, but no formal positions, nor does she care about a Nobel Peace Prize. So.
There's a Marcus Aurelius quote. He says, "Just that you do the right thing, the rest doesn't matter." Yes. And that, to me, her 1 million refugee policy, I think she probably, I don't know, the advice from Kissinger, there's probably a political truth in that, but it's also morally abhorrent to have taken that into consideration. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And yeah. So it just struck me as this, I don't want to say emotional, but you're right, it's a profoundly moral choice that she made, as opposed to a political choice. It was a moral decision, which we see so rarely from leaders. Leaders make political decisions and partisan decisions, but very rarely do they make moral decisions.
I think this is what makes her, quite frankly, the greatest, the most important politician of the 21st century, is that she was able, she's no Gandhi, but she's no Mother Teresa. She's a cunning, when necessary, ruthless, brilliant, but deeply moral politician. You know, when it's hard for me to even put those two words in the same sentence, moral politician, because it's so rare, but she is that. And the fact that she doesn't rub our noses in that, you know, we conclude that if we study, as I have studied her, that is the inevitable conclusion. But she hasn't said, I'm a moral, principled person. And, you know, she doesn't ask for our approval, which also makes her very appealing.
No, and that's why I thought the book was so important. I read a book a few years ago called Lincoln's Virtues by William Lee Miller. And he was saying that, you know, we forget, because we look at Lincoln 150 odd years ago, we see him as just a moral figure as opposed to a politician. He had the same job as every other president, and just as Merkel does. But to be able to be a politician and a moral figure, to use the imperfect art of persuasion and governance and coalitions to enact moral acts is profoundly important, even if you disagree with all the specific moral acts that person took, because that combination is so rare. We see the pragmatic or the calculating politician all the time, or the charismatic cult of personality politician, But Merkel combines the elements that we should want to see in politicians far more often.
Yeah. Oh, that's so well put, Ryan. And I would give a shout out here to the German people who value person. Seemingly unexciting, uncharismatic leader who isn't out to seduce them.
Yes.
That they would have the good sense to four times elect such a person really speaks of a mature democracy. And even in her leave taking, it's hard to avoid the comparison with our recent leave taker.
Yeah.
No attempt to argue with the outcome. In fact, she's the most popular politician in Germany by far. She could have stayed, but she chose to leave at her own speed, and then really cleared out and let the next guy get his bearings. I mean, that is how democracy is meant to work. And sad to say, it doesn't work that way in our democracy. We, who were the midwives of this Germany, really taught them well. And I don't know, something happened.
No, they you're right. They've outpaced us. They're a more mature democratic base in some ways than we are. And that is an indictment for sure.
And devastating for Merkel, who loves America. You know, of all the German chancellors, she was the one who most revered this culture. She said that among her fantasies is to drive around the West Coast in a convertible with Springsteen on the radio, which is again not how we think of Angela Merkel usually.
Well, that's so the opposite of growing up in East Germany, right? That's the most American free, Levi's jeans convertible Pacific Coast Highway. That was probably the dream that propelled her in many ways.
Absolutely, yeah. It was her first trip to the Pacific. Yeah.
Well, I absolutely loved the book. Thank you so much for writing it and for coming on. And I can't recommend it highly enough.
Thank you, Ryan. It was such a pleasure. I feel like we could go on and on.
I'm sure we could. And now I hope you write this. I think you should write a sequel to The Prince called The Princess, and it should be lessons on power and cunning from women throughout history.
Wow. I may come back to you.
I think you should write it. I'll read it in 2 seconds.
Okay.
All right.
I wish if I could write it in 2 seconds.
Yes, that would be the issue.
Yeah. Okay, Ryan, thank you so much.
You know, the Stoics in real life met at what was called the Stoa, Pokile, the Painted Porch in ancient Athens. Obviously, we can't all get together in one place because this community is like hundreds of thousands of people and we couldn't fit in one space. But we have made a special digital version of the Stoa. We're calling it Daily Stoic Life. It's an awesome community. You can talk about like today's episode. You can talk about the emails, ask questions. That's one of my favorite parts, is interacting with all these people who are using Stoicism to be better in their actual real lives. You get more Daily Stoic meditations over the weekend, just for the Daily Stoic Life members, quarterly Q&As with me, cloth-bound edition of our Best of Meditations, plus a whole bunch of other stuff, including discounts, and this is the best part, all our Daily Stoic courses and challenges totally for free, hundreds of dollars of value every single year, including our New Year, New You Challenge. We'd love to have you join us. There's a 2-week trial totally for free. Check it out at dailystoiclife.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.